Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know it's Friday, right? And that there's another big financial institution in trouble? We tried to get a peek at Henry Paulson's calendar for this weekend, you know, just to see if he had Rescue Lehman Brothers penciled in for Sunday afternoon. So far, no luck. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Congratulations on making it through another week, everybody. Today is the 12th of September. And I was kidding, of course, about Henry Paulson's day book a minute ago. It's not like he'd write it down if he was going to intervene in the markets, or at least I don't think he would. The Treasury Secretary hasn't actually said anything in public yet, but on the theory that actions speak louder than words, it is worth a mention that so far Mr. Paulson hasn't lifted a finger to help Lehman. We asked Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson to find out why not.
If Treasury does not step in and bail out Lehman, it may just be because of bad timing, says Charles Gabriel, managing director of Washington-based Capital Alpha Partners.
The real issue is that, of course, we're less than 2 months out from the elections. On one hand, I'm sure that there are those who would like to see and would applaud the Treasury Department allowing Lehman Brothers to fail, but it would be a heck of a message and probably a very, very traumatic event.
There is a big difference between this and the Bear Stearns disaster. In that case, investors were caught off guard. But Wall Street's been aware of Lehman's troubles for some time, which is why the company's stock history over the last year looks like a weight graph for someone on a really successful diet. So this time, says Quincy Crosby, chief investment strategist at The Hartford,
the government has gotten into the matchmaking business because that's really what the market would prefer.
Crosby says Treasury wants to see if Wall Street is ready to handle a bargain basement sale on a major investment bank.
You know, there's an old saying, where's liquidity when you need it? And what we're waiting for is to see if buyers will step in. That's going to give confidence, lend confidence to the market overall.
At today's stock price, Lehman looks dirt cheap, but buyers may still regard it as too risky. Washington's worry is that Lehman's failure could ripple throughout the world. So Crosby says a Treasury bailout is still a real possibility. In other words, this may be another one of those weekends. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
A pronunciation note while we have a second here. Is it Lehman, do you suppose, or is it Lehman? We're pretty sure we're right with Lehman, but we called them up just to check.
You have reached the offices of Lehman Brothers. Due to heavy call volume, you may experience longer.
You gotta love that, right? On a day like today, heavy call volumes? What do you suppose people are calling about? Financial institutions aren't the only companies poking around Washington looking for help. Car makers want low-interest loan guarantees, $25 billion worth. They say they need them to get their factories retooled so they can build hybrids and other fuel-efficient cars. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports $25 billion might only be the beginning.
Lobbying for government help today, General Motors CEO Richard Wagoner reminded senators they promised $25 billion in low-interest loans back when Congress raised minimum fuel economy standards.
Since the bill was passed last year, the capital market conditions have worsened significantly. So the ability to fund these investments from our normal cash flow from our business is significantly retarded.
Companies say private lenders are demanding 20% interest rates since prospects for profits are so dim. So car makers want government loans of 4 or 5%. David Cole, chairman of the Center for Automotive Research, says those loans are needed to avoid unemployment that could spread to industries from steel to car parts.
A serious failure of a Ford or a GM or even Chrysler could precipitate a much more serious problem. It's probably less expensive to do something preemptively than to wait and try to clean up a big mess.
Car makers point to a government loan to Chrysler 30 years ago, which the company paid back. But J.D. Foster at the Heritage Foundation says the government has no role in propping up failing businesses.
They have a cost structure that simply is uncompetitive. They have to get that under control. They shouldn't do that on the backs of taxpayers. They should do that on the backs of their shareholders.
Congress is likely to okay the $25 billion this month. After all, what politician wants more layoffs in the swing states of Michigan and Ohio? In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If mild panic in the financial and auto industries isn't enough for you, well, there's always the weather. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said today Hurricane Ike is pretty much, and I quote him here, the worst-case scenario. Forecasts are for the storm to wallop the South Texas coast and its oil refineries early Saturday morning sometime. To find out what that's going to mean for oil and gas prices, we've called economist Ray Perryman. Mr. Perryman, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
How do you go about turning off a refinery when you see a storm coming like this?
Well, it's quite a process because they actually literally have to shut down production in the refinery, and it takes quite a while because these things normally run 24 hours a day just because of the sheer difficulty that you have in shutting them down.
Let me ask you the consumer question there. Once the storm has passed, and assuming damage is, say, moderate, how long does it take to turn the pumps back on, get gas flowing again out to the consumer?
Oh, they'll get it done in a matter of just a few days. They're very good at that, assuming that the damage is minor. Obviously, if you have major disruptions in the refining process, then we have a whole different ballgame.
Mm-hmm. And then the impact on spot gasoline prices if there's a hiccup in the oil supply?
Well, you'll definitely see one. Right now, speculators are fairly calm, so I think if it's something minor and viewed as something that's kind of routine, something like what Dolly turned out to be, then I don't think you'll see much of an impact. But if you do see one of the refineries, it's going to be out of commission for quite a while, then I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a 20 or 30 cent spike in gasoline prices.
So then do you think we could have, say, $99 a barrel oil and $4 gas?
Well, I think that is a possibility given the unique situation, simply because our refining capacity is so tight in this country right now that even with the little bit of reduction in demand that we've seen, if we lost a major part of the refining capacity on the Gulf Coast, we would be in a very difficult situation. I think one that might well trigger the speculators in the oil market again as well.
There's this phrase that analysts like to use when they see a bad thing coming down the pike. They say that the market has priced in whatever's going to happen, whether it's a Federal Reserve rate cut or, you know, a hurricane in oil prices. Has the market priced in this storm yet?
Well, I think to some extent it has. Markets are efficient and tend to do that. The difficulty you have is the commodity markets are so speculative at this point in time. For example, if this had come in June, they would price it in much higher than they would today. And consequently, there's a greater chance that it may be worse than what's been priced in at this point than it was at a time when the speculators were kind of going crazy and overreacting to everything. Right now, they're in a fairly calm place.
Economist Ray Perryman at the Perryman Group. Mr. Perryman, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Oil indeed sank below $100 at one point today, not far below. $99.99 was the number. That helped the major indices close pretty much steady. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While Wall Street frets over the strength of its collective balance sheet, China is sitting on almost $2 trillion in foreign reserves, $1.8 trillion to be exact, if a couple of decimal points at that amount of money bothers you. Beijing invests it all over the world. It used to buy a whole lot of bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, actually. But a report in today's Financial Times says China's been looking for more than just a financial return on some of those deals. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gratch reports.
The FT reported secret documents show China bought $300 million in government bonds from Costa Rica. In return, Costa Rica severed its ties to Taiwan and allied itself with China.
These are bribes.
Larry Burns directs the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. China considers Taiwan a renegade province, and it wants to isolate the island politically.
There are no miracles and no accidents, and the reason why China has done so well in getting rid of Taiwan as a competitive adversary has been undoubtedly through handsome payments.
Burns says China's secret political payouts should worry the U.S., especially if those payouts give China a first shot at the world's scarce resources.
The Chinese will go to any means to put itself on the starting line, if not a few inches ahead of everyone else. This is the big league for China, and they're willing to play the game all the way.
Bill Ratliff is a fellow at the Hoover Institution. He says China has been restrained thus far in its dollar diplomacy.
Probably the main reason they have not done more is not because they didn't have the money, obviously, but because it doesn't look very good that they've just been out buying people's votes.
Taiwan itself is no stranger to bribery. In the Caribbean, it's helped fund bridges, airports, even a new stadium in Barbados for the Cricket World Cup. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Depending on who you talk to, 72 hours from now, Lehman Brothers is either still going to be going as a concern or it won't. It's a turn of events that, while possible, didn't seem likely back on Monday when the news was all Fannie and Freddie all the time. Marketplace's Amy Scott has been following developments for us this week. Hi, Amy.
Hello, Kai.
Well, what a week it was, right? We had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on Monday, and now here we are on Friday with Treasury Secretary Paulson perhaps doing something, perhaps not, about Lehman Brothers. What is going on out there?
Well, they are doing something. They're reportedly talking with potential buyers, trying to help Lehman find a solution. But it may be that they're not so willing to put up taxpayer cash this time around. You know, as Jeremy mentioned, concerns have been persisting for a long time about Lehman Brothers. Investors and the institutions on the other side of any trades with Lehman have had plenty of time to get out. So there may be not as much concern of a domino effect as there was with, say, Bear Stearns. I also heard some speculation today that, you know, it may be that Lehman Brothers has already found a buyer, which would make it easier for Paulson to talk tough, you know, if a solution were already in the works.
Yeah. Let me run down a couple of things, though. We've had the Federal Reserve offered to lend money to any banks who need it. We've had, obviously, the rescue of Bear Stearns. We've had the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or takeover, as some people prefer. Why are we still stuck in this place where nothing works? We still have the credit squeeze. We still have a housing problem. What's going on?
Well, I think some would argue that things would have been even worse had the Treasury and the Fed not taken the steps that they had. But there's a lot of fear and uncertainty out there, and people don't know what these banks still have on their balance sheets. The whole trust issue is huge. You know, if these banks can't trust each other, they're not going to lend to each other. They're not going to lend to us. Borrowing is going to be more expensive for everyone. And I think, you know, unfortunately, it's not a great answer, but the people I'm talking to are saying the solution is really going to be time, and we just have to wait.
In that regard, there are a couple of other names in the news that bear mention here. One is Washington Mutual. It's had some problems. Its share price has been under pressure. It kicked out its CEO. AIG, the insurance company, Merrill Lynch. I mean, there's no shortage of other companies in this troubled company mix.
That's right. And once the dust settles on Lehman Brothers, we may be having the same conversation next week about one of those other companies. You know, these firms need cash, and there just aren't that many people willing to give it to them right now. When this credit crunch began, we had sovereign wealth funds coming to the rescue with cash infusions. They got burned and maybe are less willing to do so now. Private equity firms may be interested in investing in some of these companies, but they apparently are lobbying to have the ability to invest more, take bigger stakes in these companies without additional regulation. And then the other problem is that there just aren't a whole lot of banks, because of what's going on, that are in a position to take on, you know, a firm like Lehman Brothers. So the options are limited.
And I guess we're going to see perhaps over the weekend if Secretary Paulson has a change of heart or if somebody steps up to make the buy, right?
Right. These things do seem to happen on the weekend. So, I'm, you know, we won't be holding our breath.
All right. But we will be calling you on Monday. Amy Scott in New York first. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, fraud by the glass.
I was at a dinner once and there was a magnum of 1947 Cheval Blanc. It's a very rare bottle. And the wine was too bold, too young, too dark in color. It wasn't possibly from that particular era.
But first, let's do the numbers. After all the excitement kind of blah on Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials trimmed about a tenth percent, 11 points, closed at 11,421. The NASDAQ nudged up a tenth percent, 3 points, finished at 2261. The S&P 500 basically traded flat, ended the day at 1248. For the week gone by, the Dow rose 1.75%. The NASDAQ inched up 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained 0.8%. Financials continued to bleed red. Some of those companies I was just talking to Amy about, AIG plummeted 30% on news of a ratings downgrade. Lehman Brothers lost another 13%. Merrill Lynch dropped 12%. Washington Mutual slid 3%. The price of a barrel of light crude ended the day at $101, but energy companies still got a lift. Valero rose 8%. Tesoro Petroleum lifted 6% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve Board reports on industrial production for August. The Air Force Association convenes its annual Air and Space Conference in Washington. And on September 15th, 1890, the English author who became known as the Queen of Crime was born. Who done it? Best-selling mystery writer Agatha Christie. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. All right, here's a real-life problem for students in Econ 101 this semester. Let's say you're a community college with a lot more students than usual because the four-year school down the road has raised tuition. Problem is you've got less cash because the state has cut spending. And if you happen to be here in California, you can't even get your hands on that money. Politicians are more than 2 months late with the state budget. So for extra credit, what does that community college do? From one campus near San Francisco, KPCC's Julie Small has the answer.
Clerks at the bookstore for Diablo Valley College ring up textbooks and school supplies for a steady line of students.
Next in line.
The college is in its fourth week of classes and all appears normal, but that's only because Kindred Murillo hasn't been sleeping much lately.
I'll have to tell you, the last 3 weeks have been scary for me because I want to know that I can make payroll.
Murillo manages finances for the school district that oversees Diablo Valley College. It's been a tough job recently. The state hasn't given the school the money it usually provides.
There has not been a payment in July. There has not been a payment in August, and we're anticipating not getting a payment in September. So the $20 million we had in reserves have basically paid the payroll for the last 2 months. So now we've depleted that.
And that's just the payroll. Murillo has had to scrounge dollars for all the college's other operating expenses, too. She asked the Board of Trustees to borrow money from employees' pensions. She got an advance from the county government, and she got a loan from a bank. The credit crunch made it tough. Banks are reluctant to lend without high interest rates. In all, the college will pay over $50,000 in interest to get through the end of November.
It's a tremendous waste of time, energy, and money.
That's Eric Skinner with the Chancellor's Office for California Community Colleges. He says California owes schools $600 million collectively. That figure could rise to $1 billion by the end of the month if the legislature doesn't break the budget impasse. Most colleges, like Diablo Valley, will have to borrow some money to fill in the gap.
The financing costs associated with borrowing are unanticipated costs. There's no compensation from the state for those expenses.
Skinner says colleges will pay the interest with classroom dollars, and that means
fewer resources will be available to pay faculty, to buy instructional equipment, and otherwise offer education. That's definitely one of the casualties of this impasse.
Another casualty is state student aid. California's lowest income students rely on $1,500 grants from the state. Those checks haven't been issued.
I got a letter saying that it wasn't going to come until the budget got passed, so I freaked out.
20-year-old Angelina DeMondon is getting her associate degree at Diablo Valley College to become an ultrasound technician. She says she relies on grant money to support her 2-year-old son.
It's just scary to think about, you know, that it's not going to come when I need it to pay bills, I need it to take care of groceries, I need it to, you know, buy things for my son that he does need on a daily basis.
DeMondon hadn't heard yet, but Diablo Valley College just decided to front state grant payments to students. The checks go out next week. Roughly a quarter of California's 110 community colleges have also decided to front money to students. The rest just can't afford the extra millions it would cost them. I'm Julie Small for Marketplace.
As the presidential campaigns continue to squabble over the economy and social policy and cosmetics on barnyard animals, parents and students might be glad to hear this. They are at the heart of one of the few places the two parties actually agree. Both candidates say they're going to reform the federal government's $150 billion student aid program. Commentator Kim Clark says that's great, but it's going to come with political costs.
It's no surprise that politicians who bill themselves as change agents are campaigning on something that looks like such a no-brainer. Just ask anyone who's ever had to gather the tax forms, pay stubs, and bank statements to fill out the 145-question federal aid application. They'll all back plans to simplify that process. And just about every parent would support political candidates who promise to get more dollars to needy students. More than 90% of those who qualify now aren't getting the aid the government says they need to afford a 4-year university. Great improvements could be made fairly easily and cheaply. Research by economist Susan Donarski shows that using tax returns instead of the federal aid application would save students and parents 10 hours of teeth gnashing a year. It would also save colleges more than $2 billion worth of bureaucratic paper shuffling. That's money that could be funneled into savings for students. Using IRS information could also make it a lot easier to alert parents early on about how much aid they'd qualify for and how much they'll actually have to pony up for college. That would give parents time to save and plan. If this is such an easy, great idea, why hasn't it happened already? Well, tax simplification is a great idea, too, but the tax code just gets more complicated every year. Why? Because people cheat. Nearly every nitpicky rule was developed because somebody tried to exploit a loophole. Whoever simplifies the aid application for the rest of us could inadvertently create loopholes for wealthy families to snag scholarships their kids really don't need. You can just imagine the attack ads political rivals would run against whoever does that. Both presidential candidates say they have the backbone to make real changes in Washington. Both say they'll reform our financial aid system. Let's hope that whichever candidate wins in November does have the courage to take the heat that change generates. Then the real winners in November will be parents and students.
Kim Clark covers money and education for U.S. News and World Report. Do take a minute to send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. It's been tricky lately to find a winner on Wall Street. If you're willing to diversify, though, there are some investments that have been going nowhere but up. Last quarter, auctioneers sold more than $66 million worth of fine wine. The Enophiles equivalent of the Dow Industrials has climbed 150% in the past 4 years. But wine collectors aren't the only ones seeing dollar signs in those bottles. Chrissy Clark has the story.
A story that involved not one, but two threats against my life. Wine counterfeiting has become a high-stakes business. The first incident was at Colgan Cellars, a boutique winery in Napa with a cult following around its lip-smacking reds.
This is 2004, number 9, estate, Syrah. Very earthy, smoky, meaty kind of character.
That sells for $240 a bottle. Owner Ann Colgan knows the wine from this bottle is what the label says it is because she got it straight from her own barrels. But she wants to make sure anyone who buys her wine now or from an auction house in 30 years gets what they paid for.
I was at a dinner once, and there was a Magnum of 1947 Cheval Blanc. It's a very rare bottle, and the wine was too bold, too young, too dark in color. It wasn't possibly from that particular era.
Sometimes it's imposter wine that's been put into an authentic empty bottle. Other times, everything is faked, label, bottle, and all. So far, the problem has centered on old, rare Bordeaux. But Colgan doesn't want her wine to be next. She's paid thousands of dollars for anti-counterfeiting technology designed by Kodak. Invisible markers are embedded in labels, corks, and bottles, and can only be detected with a handheld reader.
Kodak requires that we keep it in a safe. Only myself and my winemaker have access to it. But I can't tell you too much about it or I'd have to kill you.
Okay, so she's joking. But Colgan's top secret purchase is just one of many new efforts aimed at stopping wine fraud. Jim Hayward is CEO of Applied DNA Sciences in New York. His company's invested $90 million in an anti-counterfeiting system based on genetic tracking.
Well, of course, in wines, there's plenty of DNA extracted with the grapes. So it's possible to genotype the wine that's in the bottle to a specific batch, a specific cuvee, a specific year of manufacture.
He's hoping to sell his system to high-end wineries anxious to protect their brand. While some companies try to make a buck thwarting the counterfeiters, there's another way to capitalize on the wine fraud problem. Russell Fry is an amateur wine collector who runs the website wineauthentication.com.
Imagine an unscrupulous wine retailer who sells a bottle he or she knows is counterfeit.
5 years later, the guy who's bought it realizes it's a fake and demands a refund. But here's the kicker. Meanwhile, that vintage has appreciated, so the vendor can turn around and resell the counterfeit bottle to another poor guy for twice as much.
Great model for business if you have absolutely no scruples.
And one Fry knows more about than he'd like. A few years ago, he discovered that 80 bottles from his own cellar, supposed to be worth more than $3 million, were probably fakes. One was a rare Bordeaux from 1900.
The bottle had a seam on the edge of it. The seams were caused by an automated process of bottle making that didn't begin until sometime around 1910.
Fry has settled out of court over some of the fakes, and he's not letting his phony bottles get back into the marketplace. They're locked away in a special storage unit.
But I can't tell you the exact location.
Or you'd have to kill me again, right?
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, with an eye toward the Gulf Coast tomorrow morning, that's when Hurricane Ike is set to land somewhere in South Texas. An executive from the insurance company FM Global said today that losses could top $50 billion if the storm gets much worse. Katrina's damage came to about $40 billion. And there is short-term pain down there already. Wholesale gasoline hit $4.85 a gallon in the region today. So far, though, no reports of those kinds of prices at the pumps. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow slipped down 11 points. That's about a 10th percent. The Nasdaq scooted up 3 points, a 10th percent there as well. The S&P 500 traded flat at 1248 at the close. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, when labels save lives.
Kids have died from allergic reactions in as little as 30 minutes after taking one bite of a food that has what they're allergic to in it. That's how quickly these things can happen.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.